This week on the show, there's a gap in the Gap's social media plans. They forgot to ask fans what they thought of the new logo. Hint, they hated it. Right here on This Week in Media, number 206. Hello, everybody. This is David Bloom. I'm guest hosting today for the esteemed Daisy Whitney, who is carousing at a conference across the country. Welcome to This Week in Media, number 206. This week, we have a couple of fabulous guests, the redoubtable Tim Street, who blogs and works in the video space online, and Lon Seidman, who is the head of localonlinenews.tv and scenic historic West Hartford. How are you guys doing?
Doing great.
Doing great.
Great.
Hey, Lon.
Hey, Tim. How you doing?
Doing well. I'm at Digital Hollywood this week, where I saw David yesterday, but he's not here yet. So I'm actually coming from a closed bar at a hotel. So who knows what time the bar opens and whether or not we'll hear any customers.
See, Tim was a lot more brave than I was about doing a live cast from the conference. I'm going to wander over there in a little while after we're done here. What did you think about the show so far, Tim? Anything catch your ears?
Well, I got to listen to Michael Eisner yesterday, and in his keynote, he talked about launching a new social networking game that'll be about, you know, playing in Hollywood, and it almost feels like it's fantasy sports for Hollywood in a way on Facebook. So it'll be interesting to see how well that does, and if Zynga or any of the other social networking gaming companies rip them off and do a better job of it.
I think we can count on them ripping him off. The question is whether they'll be under federal investigation for other issues based on the stories coming out of the Wall Street Journal this weekend. All right, let's start with what's going on over at Facebook. Obviously, the social network is rocking along, though it got bumped off this week by Jackass 3D. But at the same time, Google had to look on as Facebook made a major announcement with its friends at Bing, Microsoft's surging search engine, which now controls about a third of the market through its own site and Yahoo. Tim, what did you think about this announcement?
Well, it's weird because I live inside the Google bubble and the Apple bubble, so it's, you know, I think I've used Bing once just to see what it was like, but I know a lot of people use it, and, you know, there are a lot of people that watch videos on Bing Video, and the big problem here for Google is that Google doesn't work inside Facebook. Right. And that's huge. And if Facebook is becoming the current day America Online, where people just log into Facebook and they don't go anywhere else on the internet, that's a big problem for Google. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out and how it'll affect Google. But I think Google's pretty smart. They'll figure something out.
You mean like the social networking programs that they've already put in place that have done so well?
No, but something else.
Something. So, Lon, what was your take on this? I thought this was pretty big news in terms of what I already see as a big shift from our age of search-dominated SEO and all that to a new world where it's what your friends recommend to you and what they're doing and how you connect and share things. What was your take? You run a local portal, essentially, for a hyper-local audience. This has some implications, this transformation, for even what you do. What did you think of this?
Well, you know, it's interesting when I read this because a bulk of our inbound traffic is from Google, and right. it's consumption of our older stories, which is really interesting. And we send our stuff out via TubeMogul, so we get it onto all these different video sites that kind of compete for SEO in that course. So when people are searching for something in town, more often than not, we're the video link because we've probably covered it over the last year and a half. So for me, I'm looking at it in almost two different ways. One is that when we're out marketing every new piece of content that we create, which is what we have to do these days, Facebook kind of rules the day. But again, you know, we're still seeing a tremendous amount of traffic coming in from Google. And let's not forget too that Google has had the Twitter fire hose for some time also. So there is some integration with that as well. But I almost see this, you know, we're almost getting to layers now of how we find things. That curation is what you need immediately. And then perhaps things that your friends are finding that might be more of interest to you that you weren't necessarily looking for. And I think that might be where this comes into play. But certainly Google needs to adapt to Facebook better. I just wish I was like Ashton Kutcher and I could just ask a question on Twitter and just get an answer. Have the search come to me.
Yeah, who needs Quora when you've got Ashton Kutcher's 5.8 million followers, right?
I mean, so, it's amazing. You can ask a question and get an answer. It's the future.
Absolutely. Someone knows something. I just need 5.8 million and I'm ready to roll. Right. Now, I'm interested, though, in your site because you say a lot of your sort of back catalog, as it were, gets attention through the search functions. Can you quantify from, you know, your breaking stuff to versus your older catalog, as it were, of news stuff? You know, what's the percentage that's the news stuff coming through Facebook and folks in the neighborhood saying, hey, did you see this story that just ran today versus, you know, a 2 week old or a month old or a year old story?
Week to week, believe it or not, it's about half and half. We actually changed our coverage model to kind of not necessarily avoid a breaking news story, but we found that we're doing better with things that have more life to them. So a great example would be the West Hartford Dog Park. They had a great event where they have these dogs jump into a swimming pool at the end of the swimming season, and it's such a really fun thing. And whenever people search for that, or some variation of that, they tend to get the video that pops up. So that has kind of a longer life to it. So we've actually been really shifting our coverage model to things that are less urgent and less tied to a single date or less likely to get stale, right. Mainly because we're seeing as many views of our old content daily that we do for the new stuff, which has really been fascinating as we've been going through this.
Sure. Now, Tim, in your years with the French Maid videos that you did, everything that you created was search-driven and all that, and now you're doing a somewhat broader array of video work, I guess. Are you seeing some of the same things that Lana's seeing?
Yeah. I mean, you know, when you're trying to get views, you need to be smarter in how you title your video and you know, using Google AdWords keyword tool ahead of time to kind of figure out what the best title for your video would be is a great way of doing that. I mean, SEO, not only in the title, but in the description as well. What are the things people are currently searching for, and how can you work those into the title? How can you work them into the title description, and how can you work them into the tags of that video? Those are all the things that are important when you're trying to get your video seen by people that are searching for the terms. I mean, an example of that is with French Maid, we did how to give CPR, how to change your oil. Those videos get a lot of views because people are searching for that information, and that video pops up as one of the top videos for those searches.
Now, you didn't title it, though, how to give a French maid CPR.
Yeah, because nobody's going to be searching for that.
They'll figure it out on their own, is what you're trying to say. It's the exploration that's all the fun. Well, now, the flip side of this question is not necessarily what Bing does for Facebook, but what does Facebook do for Bing? What do you guys think about that?
Well, it's user-based, right? So if we have 500 million people in Facebook, which is the estimate, which is pretty mind-boggling just to think about that, if Bing results start popping up more within the channel, I mean, that's how Zynga built their business, right? It's just all this connection to this huge Facebook user base. I'm sure it could help Bing's market share a bit, although Google still is embedded into just about every browser that I use. So I'm not sure how much it will impact market share, but for every percentage point Microsoft picks up in the search engine race, they get a lot of money. So they don't have to dominate, they just have to place, I think, at this point.
Right. And they do secretly control, not secretly, but they also, I mean, I think a lot of people use Bing and don't realize it when they go to Yahoo, which has 22%, 21% of the market still. What's your take on that? I mean, is this a bigger win for Microsoft or for Facebook?
I think it's a bigger win for Microsoft because it gives them a huge competitive advantage over Google. They're going to be able to see what's inside Facebook. They're going to be able to index it. They're going to be able to, you know, take a peek behind that wall. And Google can't. So it is a big deal for them. I mean, the only thing I think we could do is, you know, maybe if we start posting Google searches inside Facebook so our friends can see the results. Maybe that's the only way that Google's going to get in. But in terms of the stuff that's going on with Google trying to attack this, I think maybe a browser is a way for them to somehow challenge this. You know, if people start using the Chrome browser, and if the Chrome browser could somehow read what's on the screen, even if you're inside Facebook, and give you relevant advertising on the browser, that might be a way that they're, you know, the browser seems to be the only way that I can think that Google has a chance of getting inside there somehow.
And Chrome right now is running it. I mean, it's supposed to be a pretty nice little browser. I played with it a little bit. My kids both swear by it because it's pretty fast. But it's only got, what, a few percent of the market, I believe, at this point, right?
Yeah, it's pretty sexy. It'll be interesting to see how it takes over. I use several different browsers. I use Chrome, I use Safari, I use Firefox, I use OmniWeb, and I use Opera. And what I've kind of done with those is, let's say I want to be logged in as Tim Street, or I want to be logged in as MDialog, which is the company that I work for. I can switch between browsers for my different accounts. And so I just keep them separated that way rather than doing tab-based stuff where I would need to re-log in to a different, you know, Gmail account or a different calendar or whatever. Just by using different browsers, I'm able to keep my different endeavors separate, and I kind of like that.
Well, now, which browser do you like for work, and which one do you like for all the secret stuff you don't like to talk about?
Well, I definitely like Chrome for the business stuff. I like Safari more for my personal blogging stuff. Firefox I use for French-made TV-related stuff. And the OmniWeb and Opera, those are kind of my, you know, my black ops type stuff when I'm researching stuff about the future of web video and monetizing iPad content. Those are the ones that I use.
Speaking of the iPad, that's a wonderful segue. Apple sort of surprised folks with a big announcement that it was going to begin selling one of its devices with Verizon, but it was not the device that everybody anticipated. It was the iPad paired with a, what do they call it, a MiFi. Yeah.
Yep.
Can never quite figure out how to pronounce the darn thing. A MiFi, so they don't have to actually worry about changing the chips in the 3D or the 3G components inside. This seemed to be a pretty interesting little announcement, and it surprised a lot of folks. What did you guys think about that deal? Is it just the first step to a January iPhone on Verizon?
I think it was a couple things. First of all, there was some disappointing results. I mean, I don't know how you'd be disappointed with 4 million iPads sold, but there was some disappointment in some of the analysts' interpretation of Apple's iPad announcements, in that they had a hard time keeping up with demand. So I think Apple's really discovering that they've got a true consumer device here that needs to be sold everywhere consumers shop. And
right.
Clearly, Verizon has quite a retail footprint, and that's where my wife just bought her Droid phone, which I feel very sorry for her for. sorry, I'm an Apple fanboy. I'll be getting hate mail to my email address. It was interesting to see that movement, especially that it's kind of a cobbled together solution, having a separate device that you need to actually use the cellular network for data.
Right.
But it certainly does show that there is now a relationship between Apple and Verizon, and that can only mean the fabled Verizon iPhone might be nearer to us.
What do you think, Tim?
Well, I thought it was an interesting way of skirting around probably some contract issues that Apple has with AT&T. They can't sell the 3G-enabled device, iPad device yet, at Verizon, but they can sell the Wi-Fi version of the iPad because that's not under a cellular device. And for Verizon to put their MiFi along with that, that's pretty cool. I think that's a great little cheat. It's interesting, that Apple just announced that they made $20 billion this last quarter, and it's the first time they've had a $20 billion quarter, which is pretty amazing. And Steve's been talking about how they need to, keep on track with what they're doing, and making sure that this is kind of a battle of the minds for developers and customers, and that also applies to the retail space. I think they've also announced that they're going to be in Walmart as well as Verizon. So it's really, let's get those iPads out there everywhere that we can for Christmas, so that when people are shopping for those Christmas gifts, they're going to get the iPads. And what's interesting to me there, and what I think we're going to see happen, is that this year, instead of people buying DVDs as gifts, we're going to see people buying iPads as gifts. And we're going to see company executives giving these as gifts and getting them as gifts. And then they're going to go on the iPad, they're going to go to their website, and they're going to go to watch a video on their website, and they're going to see that they need to install Flash on their iPad. And I think this Christmas is really going to be a push to where we're going to see a lot of websites go, oh my gosh, why aren't our videos working here? What is this? And they're going to be embarrassed, and they're going to switch over to HTML5 adaptive bitrate streaming.
You think this is really going to drive HTML? Because, I mean, I agree with you that it's going to be iPads everywhere. I mean, we've got Walmart, Best Buy, Target, Verizon, Apple stores, AT&T stores. If you want to find an iPad this Christmas, you're going to be able to find one. You're going to be able to hook it up. You're going to be able to look at a lot of stuff. People are really going to get into this. I think one of the analysts said we're going to have estimating 12 million units sold by the end of the year, which is pretty good for not starting until a third of the way through the year. And creating essentially a brand new market segment that no one knew you needed. I would take that as a consumer electronics manufacturer any day of the century. So 12 million units, Walmart starts selling it. But you think this is going to be a death knell for Flash in some ways?
Well, I don't know if it'll be a death knell, but I think that we're going to see more companies move over to the HTML5 adaptive bitrate streaming. I mean, Apple's announced, as far as the apps go, if you're going to serve video in the app, they want you to use adaptive bitrate streaming HTML5. Although, the TED app just came out, and that right now has progressive download going on in it, where, I mean, maybe that's just an exception that Apple has done because TED is such high quality content, but I'm not sure what the thinking is behind that. But it is interesting to see that app, and that app shot up to number one this week when it hit the app store.
Yeah, I got it first thing I saw it, and it's great. So, and there's lots of content there for folks who want to hear about all kinds of interesting topics. So we strongly recommend that you download that as soon as you get through listening to This Week in Media. The other big news, and I think this is most interesting, is all the conversation this year has been about the iPad and the iPhone. Apple continues to sell computers, oddly enough, and quite a lot of them, according to its quarterly announcement, more than anybody expected. They've scheduled an announcement for tomorrow called Back to the Mac. So even Apple's turning its eye back to the thing it got started with, a computer. The invitation suggests that there may be a new operating system in the offing, and there's been lots and lots of speculation about both what that operating system improvements might look like and other things that might announce. What would be the one thing you guys each want to see in an enhanced or new operating system? Lon?
Well, I'm so happy with my Mac the way it is right now, but hopefully they don't change it too much. The one thing that I felt was interesting, I don't know if you all listened to Steve's rant on his earnings call yesterday, but He was going into the distinction between what iOS is versus Android, and that Apple's philosophy is that you shouldn't have to be a systems integrator to use the device. And OS X still is an operating system that is Unix-based. It's very, as is the iOS, but the Mac you can do more with. You can certainly run your own software. It doesn't have to be approved by anybody. I wonder how many restrictions are going to start inching their way into OS X as to what people can and can't do with their computers, if that philosophy will carry over. And in some ways, it might be a good thing for people like my mom, who doesn't use a computer often, who sometimes will have an app get all glitchy and drag the system down or install something that screws something else up. I'm hoping that there is some, you know, some middle ground that they can achieve, because it would be nice from a content creator standpoint to have some easier software to do certain things, but still have the option to have a full blown, completely accessible operating system under the hood. So I'm actually most interested to see what gets restricted or what gets pulled out or what gets adjusted in such a way that it more mimics the iOS don't worry about the under the hood stuff kind of approach that Apple's taking.
Right. So, Tim, I think that's a really interesting point, because, you know, how much of that mindset, which has really dominated a lot of the headlines and a lot of the energy for Apple for the last 2 to 3 years, how much of that does spill into that traditional standalone computer OS that's open to, you know, traditional big development teams and all that? I think that's a really fascinating question. But your thought is maybe what we do is we create some sort of overlay that allows you to either pull in the apps from the iOS or do some other thing to create quickie little things that allow you to do more interesting stuff, if you're two guys in a room kind of thing.
Yeah, for me, where my head is at about back to the Mac is always about keeping things as simple as possible and keeping them like the desktop. How does a computer emulate a real life desktop? Not a computer desktop, but the top of your desk.
Right.
And from the company that brought you the mouse and the company that took away the floppy drive, I'm wondering if we're going to see the mouse go away this time. I'm wondering if we're going to see a transition to Cocoa Touch, where you will be actually touching your screen instead of using your mouse. And I think the keyboard will probably still be there, but I'm wondering if the mouse as we know it goes away in this iteration. And you know, are we going to see Tom Cruise in the commercials? You know, are they going to go even one step further where it's not just touch, but it's gesture? I mean, the possibility is there. There's a camera. There's Cocoa Touch. There definitely is a possibility of gesture.
And you've already got Xbox rolling out the Kinect system this fall, which does that same thing for the Xbox Live experience and for gaming. So it wouldn't be a shock if Apple was also keeping that going on their side. That's a really interesting point. Certainly, they've already got the large touchscreen, or not touchscreen, but touch pads with the gestural commands. This would be a natural next step, it sounds like, right?
That sounds like that would definitely be a natural next step. I have a touchpad, the new Apple Magic trackpad on my desk, and I bought it just for the sake of experimentation. You know, will I like operating my desktop computer with this thing versus something else? And I'll tell you what, it's a great experience because those iOS gestures have been slowly working their way into a lot of these Apple apps. iPhoto and Aperture have some of that control to it. Preview, even if I have to flip over a page on a PDF now, I'm doing the little compass gesture on my trackpad versus going up to the menu or hitting Command R or Command L. So there is a lot more of that leaking in, and I'm really interested to see what components of iOS come over, because I'm very concerned that we're going to lose some control of our trucks, as Steve Jobs likes to call them, in the process of trying to make them easier to use. So I hope we'll see a good showing tomorrow. And the other thing on the hardware side is I'm really eager to get a quad-core notebook, because if that comes out, an i7 quad-core MacBook Pro, I could probably replace my Mac Pro that's getting about 4 or 5 years long in the tooth here and have something that's really portable and really powerful. So there's a lot to look forward to tomorrow.
I mean, wouldn't the problem with an i7 core or quad-core be that it would scorch your pants?
It might be, but thankfully the iPad now has eliminated most of my laptop computer usage, at least as far as it sitting on my lap. But yeah, there is some perhaps some occupational hazards with operating a computer that powerful like that. But
you're already married and have kids, so you don't care anymore, right?
Not yet, actually. And my mother keeps asking when the kids are coming. So maybe I'm going to have to be really careful about that product.
Yeah, maybe they'll come with a special lead-lined base for these things just to protect people like you. So,
a huge accessory market.
Exactly. The aftermarkets are going to be massive. There's a story out that a major decline in TV ratings overall, except in a few areas like sports. Some people are linking this to the use of apps such as on the Apple iOS. Is this silly or is there something to this, Tim?
Well, I mean, everything is a competition for eyeballs. So whether that's an iPad, an iPhone, Facebook, whatever, it's death by a thousand cuts for TV shows. And it's really hard. I mean, you need that event programming in order to gain a major audience. And that's going to be a hurdle. Now, what I think will be interesting is how we see apps integrate with television. And, you know, with Apple TV, with the iOS, I mean, some of the things that we're looking at MDialog are how do we integrate content and advertising, and how do we make that work together on the iPad, on the Apple TV, on the iPhone? And it's mind-blowing when you start thinking about what the possibilities are in terms of watching a show, a linear show, on your Apple TV and interacting with it simultaneously on your iPad. We're already controlling our Apple TVs with our iPads, with our iPhones, with the remote control feature. It's just a matter of time until we start controlling the programming and interacting with that programming. So I think it's going to change the trajectory of traditional television as we know it, but that happened in radio too. I mean, you look at the early days of television. Television was looked down upon. The great writers worked in radio. The great comedians worked in radio. And it wasn't until Milton Berle jumped over and started doing television that people started coming over to watch television. They had to see television. And we've never had a true breakout interactive experience hit other than maybe American Idol. In terms of text messaging. So that opportunity is definitely creatively there. And as we get these internet devices that, or these televisions that have the interactivity built into them, the Google TV, the Apple TV, it's going to be really interesting to see how this programming plays out.
Absolutely. Well, now, Lon, obviously, local online news, .tv has been the major source of the decline in TV ratings, at least in the West Hartford, Connecticut area.
That's right.
Metropolitan area. What's your take on what's happening? Because you are explicitly creating what is an alternative to the local broadcast station and making a living off of it and getting viewers. So what's your take on all that?
Well, I one of the first times I was on this show, I talked about a sponsor of ours who sells couches and furniture, Bob's Discount Furniture, and they have kind of put this whole thing into perspective with me that we actually design rooms around watching television. So this notion right now for us is that it's very difficult to get anything longer than a minute or two for people to watch on their computer screens or even their iPads for that matter, because it is more of a, as far as your physical position, it's more in sitting up in a working position as opposed to being a couch potato. Right. So getting content onto televisions is really, I think, for all of us as independent producers and even those who are not so independent producers, is a really critical stage of this development. And one of the things that I like about what the new Apple TV is doing is this AirPlay feature, where whatever you're watching on your iOS device, in one button push can start being projected on your television with no wires, hookups, or any kind of complicated engineering to get things up on the television. And I see that as a big potential. Apps that are driven by either device is a really big potential. So the key for everything is getting it there. Curation is going to be another problem as well, is how do you start to locate that content? But as we have apps that could know your location of the device or of that you're using, To start displaying local news and information might be pretty handy. We're actually on Vizio televisions now. Two of their newer models have a player with a Connecticut, localized Connecticut content. And when you turn the TV on and get it connected, we're popping up in there. And I think that's the kind of stuff where that localized content can be aggregated with other media providers can become a really critical phase in the development of this medium.
Great. And one last Apple thing. There are lots of rumors bubbling about among gadget makers that Apple's finally offering or about to offer a subscription music service. It's not like there aren't any already out there. What's in it for Apple? Tim?
Well, I think it's not what's in it for Apple. It's what's in it for the consumer. And, you know, if I'm spending $30 a month to buy a handful of songs and I can spend $15 a month to have unlimited access to songs, that's a win-win for me. And I don't listen to music on any other devices other than Apple devices. So it's hard for me to imagine that people would want a subscription service from anybody other than Apple. But, you know, I'm the Apple fanboy in the bunch, so it's hard for me to say.
I think we need to find a Microsoft fanboy. I mean, there's got to be one, like, you know, Bill Gates Jr., because we're a little bit Apple-y right here. So what's your thought about this, Lon? I mean, are you going to be lining up for that just like Tim to get it onto your 47 Apple devices?
Well, you know, I've been collecting and ripping my own music for the last 12 or 13, 14 years onto MP3. So I have a huge library, which I never even listened to. I've got an iTunes smart playlist to give me stuff I haven't listened to in 8 months because I have so much of it. So for me, it doesn't appeal. But I do feel that just given the install base of all these iOS devices, anything that they do to pop up a little window on your iTunes or on your device saying, hey, would you like to subscribe to an unlimited music source? There's no way they can't be successful with that. The other thing that I've observed with other similar services, because I tried Rhapsody for a while, I've poked around with a few of the other ones, the sound quality and the bit rate on the music is not as good as it would be for a purchased item. And
really?
Yeah, and Tim might have some insight on this too, but it doesn't sound as crisp and as clear as something you would have from purchasing an MP3 direct from Amazon or an AAC file from iTunes. So if Apple can really improve the audio quality of the files that they're providing in the subscription service, that could really differentiate them in the mix. Although I'm not sure the record industry is going to want to give them an advantage given their dominance of the store right now.
Well, it's an interesting question. I think Apple's had such prickly relationships with the music business on the one hand. On the other hand, they've actually created new markets that actually pay money. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of an interesting thing. You're not paying as much as you might want to pay if you're the head of Universal Music that the head of Universal Music might want you to pay. But at least you're getting some money out of them, and you're keeping 70% of that dime. So there's an opportunity here. I think you're right, though, that having it built into Ping and built into iTunes in general, and being able to do it without thinking about it as part of the credit card bill that you're already paying, it starts to be a pretty painless, simple, just like everything else that iTunes allows you to do. You look up and you spend $100 on media that month and done it in dribs and drabs, and you're quite happy to do it. There's another option that the French are pursuing in typically Gallic fashion. The French government is considering subsidizing music downloads, and the EU has said, you know, this is not anti-competitive. If you're between the ages of, I believe, 12 and 25, they'll give you 25 euros toward a 50 euro package of money. You put in half and they put in half to buy music. This seems so such an unusual approach. I'm sort of curious about what you all think about it, particularly Tim, given your experience with the French, or at least the cleaning professionals among the French.
Well, it's interesting that you'd be talking about audio right now, because the bar is starting to come alive. The bartender's setting up. He's chopping up ice right now. So I don't know. You know, in terms of the French government subsidizing stuff, I mean, they've always put such handles or handcuffs on Apple. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out and if it affects the U.S. market in any way.
I'll tell you what, I think this is completely nuts, especially in a country right now where they're having riots over raising the retirement age by 2 years.
It's to 64, by the way. It's from 62 to 64.
That's
crazy.
It's totally crazy. And my question is, who gets this money? Because what if I am someone who's not with a record label? I'm an artist. I'm selling my music online like many artists do now here in the States, and I'm sure in Europe as well. How do they get their portion of that subsidy? And it just seems to me that this is another RIAA attempt to extract taxpayer dollars from more and more people. After they're done suing everybody, they'll try to get some tax instituted to help keep a failing business model alive. And what really irritates me in all of this music stuff is that it took them about 12 years or 10 years to come around to providing music the way consumers wanted to purchase it. It took as long as it did from the late 90s when MP3s started illegally getting distributed across the internet to essentially, what, about a year and a half ago when most of the major music providers went completely DRM-free.
Right.
So we're seeing a real reaction to just how long it took for them to adjust in the marketplace. And I would hope this never makes its way to our shores, and I can see this completely failing because I don't know how the government's going to pay for that over there.
Right, they can't pay for other basic things. As much as I love music, it's hard to see it as a necessity, and it's hard to see a subsidy for some young group of music thieves being a sufficient counterbalance to those interests. I mean, at the same time, the Big Four and the behind the RIAA lost a big case in Ireland where they were hoping to force an ISP there in Ireland to do a three strikes you're out, to actually shut off customers. And a judge there ruled, no, we aren't going to make them do that. Is this something we're going to see elsewhere around the world? Is this the final denouement of the three strikes push by the music companies? Or are they going to, or do we just anticipate more lawsuits and more court action? Lon?
Well, there's a lot of countries to work their way through, so perhaps they'll try the rest of Europe first and then see where they can get at least one parliament to agree to some kind of law like this and then move forward. I think the bigger push in the United States will likely be that they'll try to blackball you from commercial networks like they do now, where you violate a term of service in Comcast and they'll ban you for some length of time. And I could see that getting into some kind of, not necessarily collusion, but some kind of agreement where you're off limits to any commercial internet provider, and they can do that without having to legislate it, and they could fight it out in the courts later. So there's a whole host of ways that they can try to crack down on these things, and it's unfortunate they're investing so much money in combating this and not trying to provide customers what they want, which is really the whole reason why a lot of people do this kind of stuff.
Right, Tim, what do you think about this? I mean, they've lost on the one side in the Irish case. They've got the subsidies on the other side. What's the real winning strategy if you're a record label at this point in things?
Well, I think the real winning strategy is whether or not you're going to be able to convince a politician that if they jump on your bandwagon, they're going to get reelected. And that's what it really boils down to in this case is, you know, this is all interesting. There are other issues that politicians are looking at. And is it something that's, you know, going to play out that they can get on TV or on the radio about?
Yeah. Now the Gap had to shift directions here. The Gap had a rather ignominious challenge to its expensive rebranding effort. They put out a new logo. It didn't look that different. It still had a blue square. It still had the word "The Gap" in it, but the square was off to the right and down a bit. And for some reason, this just infuriated social media users who follow the brand. And the Gap has backed off. Should they have crowdsourced their logo if they were going to make a change in the first place? Now that we're back to the old Gap, they clearly had a credibility gap and an understanding gap. What do you think, Lon?
Well, maybe I'm getting cynical, but I think this whole thing was a setup. it just doesn't, you know, there's a lot of things that happen in viral media that really were well engineered ahead of time and well thought out.
Cynic you.
I'm a cynic. I'm just going to be the curmudgeon on this one. It just strikes me as just very convenient that the way this whole thing panned out. They came out with a logo that was really totally it was okay looking. It was very artsy. It was a big gap in the middle of it. It just looked weird. And it got people talking about a brand that we don't usually talk about. The Gap hasn't really been something that's been fresh in my mind for a while. I mean, I've shopped there probably recently at wherever my wife makes me go shopping. But I just don't think about the Gap that often. And look what it did for them. They spent practically nothing. They probably had to pay an artist to design the logo. I don't think they actually changed any of their store signs yet to reflect this new thing. And they were able to generate a tremendous amount of earned media and get a lot of people fired up enough to go on Facebook voluntarily protesting about this change. It was a huge win for them, and it cost them nothing.
So, Tim, do you think this was a setup too? This was a cleverly engineered antiviral campaign?
I'm kind of with Lon on this, but just for the sake of argument, I'll take it to the other side for a second. Wow. We should have listened to our audience. We should have listened to our consumers to get their opinion. Boy, were we wrong.
That sounded heartfelt and meaning.
Absolutely.
Like you really meant it. That's good to know. So I wonder if they're laughing all the way to the bank here.
I am sure they will be.
Yeah, I don't know about laughing all the way to the bank, but they definitely got a lift, and we're talking about it. So you know that if we're talking about it on This Week in Media, it's important.
It must be important by definition. That's true. So AOL, speaking of people needing a lift, AOL and Yahoo, there were rumors that AOL was kicking the tires on Yahoo, which is much, much bigger than the now considerably shrunk down AOL, but that they were looking at maybe buying Yahoo. This has kicked the stock up for Yahoo quite a bit. Is this what's going to make Yahoo stock and Carol Bartz look good, or are we going to have to get like something that actually matters? What do you think, Lon?
Well, AOL and Yahoo are kind of on the same course to shift away from, in Yahoo's case, a business model that they kind of, or a business marketplace that they kind of lost into Google as far as search and directories and whatnot. And AOL, who had a very obsolete product, dial-up internet that got delivered to you on a floppy disk, but they're both converting themselves into these content companies, these content drivers, these content creators. AOL has sites like TMZ and Patch and other things, and Yahoo has very similar properties, but also Flickr and other places where it's mostly content-driven. I think it could be a good match if the money could get worked out between the two of them. I think they're finding that they are starting to make some strides on the revenue side. Yahoo has a pretty sizable partnership with a lot of newspapers, providing an advertising network that many of them are using to sell local ads in addition to pulling in network ads as well. So they've done a lot, both companies, and it could be kind of a good match, or they could actually be pretty big competitors as the shift that these two companies are doing happens. A good example of a similar company was IBM, that went from making hardware to becoming a very large business consulting entity. So there are some smart people at the helm of both of these companies. They're certainly struggling now, but they're smartly recognizing where content is and how to make money on it.
So Tim, what do you think? I'm betting given the conversation we previously had about Bing and Facebook, that there's no way that Microsoft lets Yahoo, with whom it has a 10-year search deal, will let AOL, which is related to Google, take over Yahoo. And they already tried once and got stiff-armed when Jerry Yang was still running the shop. What do you think?
Yesterday at Digital Hollywood, Paul Cantonis from For Your Imagination, or he used to be at For Your Imagination, he was on a panel with someone from AOL, and he offended her by saying something to the effect, you're just an email company. But they are a content company. They're buying a lot of content. They're creating a lot of content. And they're using email to drive people to that content. So the way that Google drives people with search, they're driving people with their email. And, you know, that for that older crowd that still uses their AOL address, that's pretty powerful stuff. And that those are the baby boomers. So there's definitely buying power that's there. Whether or not Microsoft will let them go after Yahoo, that'll be interesting. But it does seem that both of them are really focused on that local market, and they understand the power of that local market. You know, Yahoo is definitely a technology company, and AOL has been a, you know, an enabler of internet access, an enabler of email. So it'll be interesting to see how they both head down this content path.
Okay. Now, Ad Age had a piece by Judy Shapiro this week where talking about all the shifts and changes in the really old media, not just the old media, which would be AOL and Yahoo from 10 years ago, but the really old guys. We're talking about things like ABC, whose 13-year news president just stepped down. Jeff Zucker, who got canned finally, improbably, by somebody by Comcast ahead of the NBC Comcast merger. The head of CNN went out the door. Rick Sanchez got canned at CNN as well. Howard Kurtz is leaving the Washington Post to go over to the Daily Beast. Newsweek, the Washington Post also sold Newsweek off to Sidney Harmon for I think a dollar plus a year subscription. And Business Week, of course, was bought by Bloomberg, and that's all been happening just in the last several weeks. I mean, what's going to happen to the old media? Are they dead? Should AOL be buying them instead?
That could be what happens eventually. You know, AOL is certainly doing some acquisitions and some competition against old media, but let's not forget that these brands have tremendous age behind them, to the point where in Connecticut there is not a soul walking this earth who has never not had the Hartford Current in their lives, because they've been around since 1764, I think, was when they first started publishing. How those publications look in the next 5 or 10 years is going to be significantly different, but those brands say a lot, and they have a lot of trust behind them. And irrespective of who actually owns them or who's in charge of them, the old media could still be in a place to dominate. We've been doing some consulting work in addition to our news production for some smaller papers. And even within these small hyper-local communities, these papers are getting tremendous web traffic, even without a lot of marketing of those particular sites, because they're the source of information. And sure. I feel there's a real tremendous stock that those folks have because of that. It also, there's a lot of new media celebrities who became that way because they had some old media credentials and connections. So I don't think old media is dead yet. I think there's the market's going to be a lot more competitive for them with startups like us out there, but they should not be counted out or underestimated.
So, Lon, is it true that you guys are acquiring the Hartford Current as part of the bankruptcy?
Point. Okay. At some point, I would love to. You know what? I'll tell you what. I mean, you know, we're certainly in no position to do that now, obviously, but to have a brand like that would be immensely valuable because it is so trusted.
So, Tim, what do you think about this? Is there an opportunity for these brands to remain powerful, or do they have to still go through the fire, as it were, and shift who they are and what they're doing?
Well, if they don't do it, someone else will. I mean, you take a look at what the train industry went through. As airplanes came about and as air travel became commonplace, the train companies all said, well, we're train people. They didn't realize that they were in the transportation industry, and they went out of business. And the same thing's happening here. Newspapers are in the information business. And to say that, you know, we're a newspaper is just stupid. It's ludicrous to think that you have to print your content on a paper in order to monetize it. And you take a look at the music industry. They said, well, we're not going to put our stuff on the internet because people will steal it. So Apple figures out a way to do it and beats the record companies at their own game. That's going to happen here if they don't figure out how to move forward without totally cannibalizing their current industry. I mean, Blockbuster's going through it right now. They filed for bankruptcy because they couldn't figure out how to stay up with Netflix.
The tricksters over at the Jackass at Club Jackass came up with a brand new camera to shoot their hijinks in 3D, and they put out a movie that cost them maybe $23 million, and its opening weekend it stunned everybody by making $50 million. How much did 3D have to do with the success of that show, Lon?
I think it has quite an impact, and to some degree the 3D might be what saves movie theaters when all of our 85-inch plasma televisions come down in price and continue working their way into living rooms. I've actually had more of an interest in going to the movies lately because of these 3D movies. I'll admit I'm Jackass 3D is not on my list right now, but I think that's been something that's been a great boon for theaters, and not so for home theater, just because there's a lot of equipment you have to buy. But going to the movie theater, it's something that you can't really do at home right now with some of this 3D technology. You don't have to buy any additional equipment. They hand you the glasses when you walk in. There's some tremendous market potential for these 3D movies.
So, Tim, did the prospect of seeing exploding excrement in 3D, was that enough to get you in the theater this weekend?
Yeah, I was there. I saw it. I was really shocked just by the crowd that was there. It was a tougher crowd than any movie that I'd ever gone to in this theater. I saw it in Glendale at an upscale theater, and the crowd that was, I was the oldest person there, and there were a lot of people that looked like they belonged in gangs that were there. And there was one guy sitting next to me that was, you know, pretty well tattooed and pierced up, and you know, was flying his colors. I thought he was going to puke. I thought he was going to throw up. The film is so disgusting. I thought a gang member is going to blow chunks on me, which is better than me blowing chunks on a gang member, I guess. You know,
yeah.
There are some ramifications there. But I was shocked at the crowd that it brought in, who it was. I mean, it was definitely people in their 20s that filled the theater that I was in. And I went to probably a 7:30 showing on a Saturday night, and everyone loved it. I mean, it is a spectacle. And, you know, if you look at the history of entertainment, whenever there's a technological advance, spectacle comes first, then story. Well, 3D came out a long time ago, and it wasn't until Avatar that we really had, well, maybe Jaws 3D. No, I take that back. Avatar was a little bit better story than Jaws 3D. And that took a while for us to get there. I mean, James Cameron did the same thing with special effects technology with Terminator 2. That was really the first, you know, Star Wars to a certain extent, but Terminator 2 was where we had that new wave of special effects that was spectacle, and then it turned into story with Terminator 2. Well, with any advance that becomes a success, a lot of people will look at it and go, well, it's the 3D. That's what made it popular, and they don't look at the story. And so Jackass has a history of a story of who these guys are, and they've been doing Jackass for a while. And Jackass 3D has spectacle, both on a 3D standpoint, but also just on normal Jackass content is spectacle in and of itself. So I think this is a perfect marriage of a little bit of story just in these guys and where is Johnny Knoxville now, and combine that with new technology and that has spectacle itself and content that is spectacle itself, and you get 50 million at a box office on a weekend.
Well, that reminds me that we are about at the end of this spectacle. Thank you, everybody. Just a reminder to our listeners to become our friend on the TWIM Facebook page at www.facebook.com/pages/thisweekinmedia. Tim Street, where can we find you online?
You can check out my blog at onetimstreet.com. Follow me under Twitter at onetimstreet. Or if you're interested in serving ads on the iPad, check out mdialog.com.
And Lon Simon, where can people find you and the West Hartford, all the news that matters?
All the news that matters is at localonlinenews.tv, and we occasionally have things that actually have a broader interest, so be sure to check us out occasionally there. And I can be found on Twitter at LONSEIDMAN, and I'll be tweeting from the Space Shuttle Discovery launch coming up at the end of the month. So I'll be part of the NASA tweet up down there, so really looking forward to that.
So follow Lon on Twitter and blast off into space.
That's right.
If you're looking for me, David Bloom, you can find me at David Bloom on Twitter. You can also find me at david@thinkgasm.com, one of my companies. This mess you've been listening to, this spectacle you've been listening to, was recorded on October 19th, 2010. We are over and out.
This Week in Media is a PixelCore.tv production produced by Suzanne Llewellyn with technical producers John Riley and Alutha Jamankar. Content contributor is Jason Perrier.